It's Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
Green Bay is set to host the Street Fishing World Championship that opens with a Parade of Nations ceremony a week from today.
10 teams from across the globe will compete in this fast-growing sport among anglers in urban areas who cast their lines from shore. We'll hear from Team USA in just a bit.
But first, Wisconsin Today producer Beatrice Lawrence went out to talk with some anglers in Madison to find out what they like about fishing in the city.
Here's Ling Yang, who is fishing off the train tracks on Lake Monona.
I was born in Thailand, but grew up here in Madison, so, oh no, stuck in the weeds. My dad teaching me how to fish all the way from when I was a little kid. First spot I started learning was at the zoo at Lake Winger over there. Yeah. And then started learning everywhere else, the rivers and bigger lakes like this. It's closer to home, definitely, so I don't have to drive too far for gas-wise, but, and I mean, every now and then you get nice big fishes too, which is nice, but I've been able to get my nephew over there to start fishing, but I've been trying to teach like all my younger nephews and everyone too, but I guess overall it's just good like life lessons. I mean, learning fishing is like a good patient testing, like why it's like, you know, because you do need a lot of patience for fishing, because if you don't, then you're not going to get any fish.
Right. Yeah. My name is Charles Grady, and I'm from Milwaukee. I fish all over. Fish Beaver Dam for catfish and crappies, also fish other places. All right, the cities, you don't have far to go. Madison here is a little different. You have to use a different jig, like a lead head jig, small one. Like on the outlying area, like those lakes, you get away from that and you use artificial and mostly minnows and not so much panfish unless you're in a boat.
Ryan Johnson from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Guy in the blue shirt down there. Okay. He's a Vietnam veteran. He always take me fishing.
Can I get your
this
name?
This is Mike Spencer. You know, I'm here with some friends, so they may want to keep the probably some bluegills is what we have been catching so far. At least I only caught one, but
sure.
Yeah. So, you know, I know there's some notifications along here about keeping the fish, I think. Mm-hmm. But basically it's just for the fun of it. I just enjoy getting out wherever, in the city or in the country or, yeah.
James Bartels. Okay. This is my honey hole. Every fall you'll find me up here. Well, the traffic's pretty heavy, but once I get up here and at this time of year, I know I'm going to have luck. Because I can just tell the temperatures are dropping and they're moving in here. They're packing in like thieves. I eat them. Otherwise, I wouldn't be up here catching them. But I get the impression that eventually they don't want fish in here. It's okay to come flying through with your nice boats, you know, but yeah. Not everybody has a boat. Not everyone has a boat. You got no choice, you know, on a weekend, bring your kids out. I grew up fishing this area with my Uncle Ed, right under here for crappies. But I got smart, I figured out the bluegill technique.
Now, for a look at street fishing at the elite level, we're joined by two members of the USA street fishing team. Lee Young of Green Bay is a competitor and coach. He's president of U.S. Angling's street fishing discipline. And Chris Ledvina of Shano is also a competitor and coach. He's incoming president for U.S. Angling when Lee retires next year. Chris and Lee, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having us.
Welcome to street fishing.
Indeed. Lee, starting with you, as a sport, how is street fishing different from other types of ways that anglers catch fish?
Yeah, it's a funny name, street fishing. What it basically means is urban shoreline artificial baits fishing. So you're standing on the shoreline, no boats, no electronics, nearly everything you can catch with an artificial bait counts. It's measured and securely, safely released, uploaded to an app. Longest total number of fish generally wins the event.
Chris, have you explored artificial baits and experimented with them?
Oh, 100%. You know, every time on the water, we're constantly trying different baits, different techniques, especially now with the changing seasons. That makes it more of a more of an interesting battle with the colder weather, and the fish start getting lethargic and going into winter patterns, fall patterns. So we're constantly trying to dial in our artificial lures, trying to get these fish figured out. So
Lee, you and all of the members of the U.S. street fishing team all hail from Wisconsin, it looks like. Why does our state dominate?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. First reason is upper Midwest urban, so city, town fishing, we have a lot of opportunities. There are a lot of anglers who grab a rod, net, box of lures, go out on the street to their nearest canal or their nearest city river and fish. So we do have a lot of people who do that. Second reason is we're a new and growing discipline for US angling, so we don't have a lot of money. So we couldn't really go visit every angler who wants to fish for the USA team in every part of the US. We'd spend thousands of dollars traveling around. And if we did select those anglers, they then need to spend thousands of dollars coming up to us to fish with us to be a part of an actual team. It's not individual fishing. All the anglers will fish as two pairs for their nation. Because it's fishing as pairs, you really have to get to know each other and be able to just react and relate without having to spend time on words.
And then in this championship, Lee, what makes a good teammate?
Well, my teammate's the best. He's quiet when I need him to be, very noisy when he's caught a fish and I need to know, because the pair angler who hasn't caught a fish has to immediately help net and look after the fish. Because it's all about fish safety and their welfare. So I need to know when Eric hooks up a fish. Very, very good at what he does, and he complements my skills and experience. And being a local Wisconsin boy rather than me an implant, his experiences are very different from mine.
Chris, how about you? What makes a good partner here?
Well, my partner is Adam, and we work well together because he's a finesse fisherman and I'm a power fisherman, meaning he uses real slow, delicate techniques, and I run through there and I try to bomb him as quick as I can and catch him right away, you know. So we work well together as a team, and that's why we complement each other so well. So that's what works good for us.
Chris, how did you get hooked, so to speak? You're in Shano, from what I understand.
Correct. Well, from an early age, ever since I was younger, in high school, middle school, pedaling my bike, fishing streams, fishing from shore, that's what I've been doing, and that's what I really enjoy, because you can kind of get off the beaten track, get away from people, and find your own little niche, and it's pretty relaxing and pretty fun. So, you know, from a young age, I've been doing it ever since, and it's a lot of fishing is overlooked from the shore. Everybody's got a boat these days, and they want to go out and use the electronics, where we go on the shore, and we kind of do our own thing. So it's kind of a fun situation, and I thoroughly enjoy it.
A little bit lower tech, it sounds like.
Correct. And this makes you actually a better fisherman without the electronics. So now, instead of the fish finder saying, oh, the fish are here, we got to use our skills and find where the fish are and then make them bite. So it's a little more of a challenge, and I like the challenge.
Chris, so there are two training days on the calendar of this championship. What happens on the training days?
Well, we do one of two things. Either we got it figured out and we just try some off-the-wall techniques, or we're going to still be casting our things that we think are going to be working and trying to figure more patterns out. So it's like Lee always says, it's smoke and mirrors, you know. So we don't know exactly what we're going to do on our practice days yet. We're going to kind of let the weather decide what we're going to do with that. But, you know, so if you're watching us, you ain't going to really know if we're really fishing or if we're just playing with you guys. So it's going to be interesting.
Oh, my goodness, Lee, it sounds like there are some tactics to be had on these training days, a little bit of bluff here and there.
Yeah, it's highly tactical. Last year, we were in Peschiera Delgada in Italy for the World Championship. I have friends in the English team. They obviously made a special point of making sure that I only saw the stuff they would not use during the World Championship.
Oh.
It didn't fool me, but I still didn't know exactly what their tactics were going to be. And I made the wrong tactical decision, as it turned out, and they made the right one. They got silver medal and nearly won the world championships. So I'm hoping that this year I will, in a nice way, in a friendly, competitive way, turn the tables on them. And we will show them during the training days and the practice days everything that we're not going to use. And then, as Chris said, on the day we'll switch it up and hopefully we'll catch a few big fish early. And
this is like a whole other, it's a whole nother facet of this discipline that I had no idea.
Yeah, well, one of the great things about it is because we're fishing from the shoreline, anyone who wants to come along and see us can literally walk straight up to us. And as long as they're respectful distance, so we don't hook an ear or a nose, you know, they can be part of the action. They can see the world's best artificial baits anglers on the shoreline next to them catching fish, or failing to catch fish, I suppose, if it's going to be really hard. We don't know what the weather's going to do to us. We don't know how the fish are going to respond. They can't tell us what they like. We have to ring the changes and present them something they like to eat. And then we'll see how that works. The great thing is the spectators get to see all of that.
We are talking with two members of the USA street fishing team. Lee Young of Green Bay and Chris Ledvina of Shawano is here. And they'll be competing in the 2025 Street Fishing World Championships at sites along the Fox River in Green Bay and surrounding communities later this month. Lee, I think you mentioned, you know, this street fishing discipline, it's relatively new. Where is the sport headed?
It's at this moment the fastest growing competitive angling discipline in the world. So what happened after the pandemic? People were allowed out of their lockdowns around the world, but they weren't necessarily allowed to travel long distances. So they ended up fishing their local community waters, their park lake or their park river in their cities. And it kind of grew up from that. Groups of anglers got together and competed against each other. Fast forward about 5-6 years, and it's a very rapidly growing sport. We actually have two new nations coming this year that weren't at the last three World Championships. And the Street Fishing World Championships has only been run for 4 years. This is the fourth event. So this year we have the Philippines sending a team to Green Bay and the pier. We have the Benin Republic in West Africa sending a team. It's going to be interesting to see what they need to do to cope and how they're going to make the fishing happen for them. And obviously we want to welcome them, and we hope they do well. And we'll give them all the help and support we can, because they're just like us. 2 years ago, you know, when Chris and I went to Mantova in Italy for the second World Championships in 2023, we were just like the Philippines and Benin this month. We didn't know what to expect. We were a bit of a wild card. We just had to try and figure it out during the practice sessions.
So, you know, Chris, someone comes up to you as you're in the championship and as they check out what you're doing. What is your best Wisconsin street fishing advice to other anglers who want to try this out?
My best advice is, if you're getting into the sport, I always tell people to go to your local bait shop, talk to them. They're more than willing to help you out, send you in the right direction, tell you what's going on, tell you what they're biting, and set you up the correct way so you don't go out there and fail right away. You know, that way you can get all the information you need to know before you go out there and be like, oh, this fishing sucks because I don't have the right tools for it. You know, so that's my best advice. I tell people, just go to your local bait shop and then talk to them, and they can point you in the right direction. You know, and we're more than willing to help when we're fishing. You know, if you got questions, come up to us and ask us. We're more than willing to help you out too. So
how about for you, Lee? What is your best advice?
Well, like Chris said, you can't do better than local advice. What I would add to that is, as Chris was saying, we're very approachable. We try to be. So if someone's out fishing and they see a guy with the USA cap on, just ask us. We might even lend you some bait or swap you some bait, some artificial baits. We'll show you what we're doing. The only time we have anything to hide is during a world championship. And that's because it's for national pride. Every nation wants to win. Other than that, I want to see people catch fish. I want to help people catch fish. And so I'm very happy to discuss what I'm doing, why I'm not catching, why I am catching, why we're catching different species. The key thing for anglers getting into street fishing, into urban artificial baits angling, is don't try and buy everything. Mm-hmm. Don't try and buy all the rigs and gear you need. Try a couple of things that local advice have told you works for your location and learn from there.
Well, Lee and Chris, go Team USA. All the best to you. Good luck. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for your support. And if any spectators want to come along and say hi, we'll be very happy to see them.
And that is Lee Young of Green Bay and Chris Ledvina of Shano. They are competitors in the 2025 Street Fishing World Championship in Green Bay, which gets underway next week on the Fox River. Still ahead, a middle grade author from Madison shares her passion for writing about spooky topics with a side of humor. Her new novel is set in a school for ghosts.
These horror books allow kids to really experience scary situations in a safe environment where if it becomes too much, they can just kind of close the book and come back to it later.
The book Phantom Academy, that's next from WPR News.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to Wisconsin Weekend.
Halloween is right around the corner. The holiday originates from an ancient Celtic ritual when it was believed the spirits of the dead circulated among the living.
A new middle grade novel called Phantom Academy explores what the afterlife might be like for a group of young ghosts. The children find themselves at a school to learn how to be the best ghosts they can be.
Christine Vernig of Madison is a former pediatrician. It is her fourth children's book. Christine, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your new book features this 12-year-old boy named Finn who dies from being hit in the head by a coconut, you know, while his family is on vacation. Finn has to navigate the afterlife. What made you want to explore, you know, this grim scenario for kids?
Actually, I didn't come into it with that plan at all. Rather, the whole idea of the first scene with the coconut just came to me one night as I was trying to fall asleep. And so when I woke up in the morning, I was super eager to write it and then discover what would happen next. So, I didn't come into it with any plans like that. It just kind of happened.
Is that how you carry your writing? Like you don't have it very planned, that you just kind of see where it goes in some respects?
Yeah, for the most part, when I'm writing fiction, that's exactly what happens. Like in my debut novel, where there was this kind of big question, you know, I didn't even know the answer to it until I was over halfway done writing. With Phantom Academy, once I discovered that there was a really big mystery component to it, I did sort of stop writing and sort of plot out the rest just to make sure that I had like all the little pieces in there. But normally I'm kind of a discover as I go along kind of author.
And Finn winds up in this academy for recently deceased children to train how to be a better ghost, a good ghost. And he meets these other kids who died these untimely deaths. There's the one was run over by a scooter, another fell into a ravine. Is it important for children to contemplate death?
That's a great question. I think it can be important. And certainly, you know, in my day job prior, you know, I was a pediatric allergist. And so I had a lot of kids who had food allergies. And definitely for those kids, you know, they were contemplating death, you know, quite often, whether they actually verbalized it or not. And so I think that, I don't know whether it's really important or not, but definitely a lot of kids are thinking about it and they're having grandparents who are passing away or other loved ones. And so it can be really maybe helpful or therapeutic to really think about that topic.
There's also this tension in the book, among the children to remember their families, remember their memories, but also in a sense move on. Were you trying to help address that emotion of letting go, but also moving on?
That was a big part of it. I wouldn't say I necessarily had that goal, but I did want to really walk that line carefully of moving on, but letting go.
Why did you give up practicing medicine to become a children's author?
That's a great question. So I really did like a lot of things about medicine. I love the one-on-one interaction with my patients. I love feeling like I was helping them. I definitely love waking up in the morning feeling like I was going to make a difference. But there were a lot of stresses associated with the job. You know, staying on time, answering all patient calls and my charts and finishing my notes in time to get home to my family. And just worrying about, you know, accidentally causing someone harm by prescribing a medication that had a side effect. And so after, you know, I stuck it out for maybe a decade or so, and then I decided that it was just time to hang up the white coat. And luckily by then I had already started writing, and so I was able to pivot into something else that I felt also very passionate about.
How does writing make you feel?
Oh, just it makes me feel so happy. I love everything about it, minus the stresses of actually publishing something. But it's really a therapeutic thing.
You've written a couple books now that have like a Halloween or a horror theme. Do you have a special attraction to that? Why go that direction?
Yeah, so I just think spooky is so fun. And I'll admit that I'm really a giant chicken in real life. Like, you will not find me at a horror movie unless I stumble in there accidentally. And I really don't know if I could handle reading an adult horror novel. But middle grade horror is perfect for me. And I also really do love the benefits that it has for kids. You know, these horror books allow kids to really experience scary situations in a safe environment where if it becomes too much, they can just kind of close the book and come back to it later. These books often show kids kind of teaming up to fight against evil. They show good triumphing over bad. And especially this day and age where there's a lot of scary things going on, I think these books can really be a great safe place for kids. So for all that reasons, I just really love the spooky genre.
You've also written a couple of nonfiction children's books that are focused on dung.
What's
up with those?
So my debut nonfiction, which came out in 2020, is Dung for Dinner. It's a stomach-churning look at the animal poop, pee, vomit, and secretions that people have eaten and often still do. And then last year, Waist Deep in Dung, which is a stomach-churning look at the grossest jobs throughout history, came out. And they're both full, you know, of a bunch of history and medicine and just a buttload of gross facts. And as far as how it can, I mean, it's just fun. Like, I really think my brain is confused and thinks I'm still 10.
It's okay.
I have that sense of humor of a 10-year-old, much to the embarrassment of my children. So it was just really fun. Plus, with my medicine background, it was kind of fun to, like, you know, explore that a little bit as well through these books.
And those books go to the heart. I mean, they are very focused on what the content is.
Yeah.
Those titles tell it all.
Yes, they do. I don't need to explain them in any way.
Do you think that there's a difference between writing nonfiction and fiction? Clearly, Phantom Academy for you is you know, fiction and not real, but there are so many things that feel real about it, especially the relationships.
Yeah, so I would say they're definitely different in the sense of, like, the pressure to have things be right. My voice, I think, is very similar in both of them as far as, like, how I write. The humor, I think, is very similar across all of my novels. But in one, I'm, like, needing to really fact-check everything, whereas in, you know, Phantom Academy, you know, yeah, I'll look up when, you know, I'll look up things that might be relevant, but it doesn't have that pressure to them. And I do want things to be realistic for the patient, for the characters as well. So there definitely is that in there.
We're talking with Madison author Christine Vernig about her new middle grade novel, Phantom Academy, and her other works. Christine, one lesson to me that sticks out in Phantom Academy's ending is to be in the moment instead of these young ghosts thinking constantly about home and what their lives were like. I mean, Finn discovers he can focus on what's right in front of him and the present. What did you want to convey about being present?
Yeah, so I do think that being present is something that we all struggle with. I know I definitely do. I tend to live in thoughts of, you know, what I could have done differently in the past. I'm sure after this interview, I'll be rethinking all of my answers. But I think it can be really powerful if you can stay in the moment and really be aware of what's going on around you. And I think that the lessons that Finn and his friends learned could really be meaningful, not only to kids, but to any adult who happens to read the book as well.
Mm-hmm. There's also this mantra that stays with Finn in the afterlife. It's, you know, how his mother always told him, think before you act, uh-huh. Finn. Why did you pick that advice?
Yeah, I think, so I am not like Finn at all in the sense that I'm not impulsive. I think things through to a really high degree. You know, like, do I want peanut butter M&Ms or peanut M&Ms? You know, that question there could take me forever to figure out. With that said, growing up, my mom always told me to think before you speak. And so I think I still hear her voice all the time in my head. And so I think that was kind of where that came from.
Okay, yeah. Do you think that your character is able to learn that skill? I mean, it is a skill that is something that you kind of have to work on.
Yeah, and I did try to make it so that he learned that skill as he went along, or at least started to have some more awareness as to why maybe being always impulsive and jumping into everything head first could be causing some problems. And so, you know, hopefully a reader will notice that he's kind of learning that skill.
You mentioned M&Ms and Phantom Academy being written to appeal to younger children. All your books, you know, written to that younger audience. Some have poop jokes and kind of bittersweet sarcasm. Mm-hmm. How did you get in the mode of writing for tweens?
For whatever reason, that is just what naturally happens. So whenever I write, whenever I put pen to paper or finger to keyboard, it always ends up coming out kind of that way. Even when I was writing doctor notes, quite honestly, if other doctors had looked through them, they would have found some really interesting things in there where I just had to throw something in there.
Can you give an example?
Yeah, like when kids have like lots, or adults or whoever, have lots of dried boogers in their nose, I'd say, you know, dry bats or bats in the cave, or, you know, there's things like that. Dried bat boogers in the cave, I think, is the way that I'd usually word it. So things like that.
That is very official doctor terminology.
Oh, absolutely.
Do you also have to observe young people, or do you find that you're able to just get ideas based on things that you see in your own life?
Yeah, so I don't necessarily like go out to observe. I do have two kids. They're now, how old are they? Geez, 18 and 20. So they're, you know, they're beyond that age.
Yeah.
But, you know, obviously when they were dealing with their friends, I was always kind of, you know, observing throughout and just kind of getting things by osmosis.
Do you think if you hadn't been a doctor, would your writing be different?
Oh, geez. Would it be different? I suspect that it probably would. I actually can't, like, pinpoint in what way it would, but I can't imagine that all that experience hasn't influenced it in one way or another.
Hmm. Do you celebrate Halloween at your house?
Oh, geez, Halloween. I have like a love-hate relationship with Halloween. So there are parts of Halloween. I think I love everything around Halloween. So I love the decorations. I adore the candy.
Sure.
I like that it happens in the fall with like the fun fall colors and the leaves crinkling under your feet and the crisp fall air. But I hate costumes. I just always feel so awkward in a costume. And even growing up, as much as I wanted the candy, I always felt really silly knocking on doors and asking people to give me stuff. So I'd say I don't necessarily like the holiday itself, but absolutely everything around it I adore.
Even ghost costumes?
You know, maybe if I threw a sheet over my head, like, maybe that's the costume for me.
You know, some people think they have these really great books in hand, all written, but finding an agent or being able to find a publisher, it's really difficult out there. Do you have any tips or advice?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. It's really hard. I was really lucky. I absolutely adore my agent. And I think the only advice that I can give would be to just keep writing, to not give up. don't compare your experience with anyone else. I think it's really easy to compare and say, well, she got an agent really quickly, therefore my writing isn't very good. But we're all kind of on our own path, and some things happen quicker for some people than others. And then critique groups. I mean, I'm a member of three different critique groups, so I get feedback on everything that I write. And I think that can be really, really helpful as far as making it as good as you possibly can.
I want to ask you about reluctant readers. I have one at home.
Okay.
For those sixth, seventh, eighth grader, students who really need to start reading and absorbing, do you have any tips or advice for families?
Yeah, I think finding things that really that deal with subject matter that they're interested in can be helpful. I know some people talk down on graphic novels, but I think graphic novels can actually be a great way to get kids interested in reading, and they often have a vocab that's even higher than conventionally written books. And so I think that can be a really neat way to go about it. And then just letting the kid read what they want rather than trying to put your ideas onto them. I know I did work for a couple years at the Fitchburg Public Library, which was fabulous, and I loved it. And it was really fun to try and figure out what books might get what kid excited about reading. And so, talk to your librarians, and they might have some really great ideas.
You have to do some detective work to figure out where they can jump in.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you miss medicine?
Oh, I miss the interactions with the patients a lot. I do not miss the rest of it.
Mm, yeah. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I loved it.
Christine Vernig of Madison is a former pediatrician who is now a middle grade novelist. Her latest book is Phantom Academy, about a school for ghosts. She also wrote A Bite Above the Rest, set in a small Wisconsin town where every day is Halloween, for better or for worse. And let's hear from you. Is there a spooky book you remember from your childhood? Maybe you read the Goosebumps series, like Night of the Living Dummy, Slappy, anyone? Email about your memories of spooky stories as kids, wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up, a Wisconsin project gives people in prison a chance to prepare for life after their sentences are over.
All these things that we want people to be when they come home from prison, all of that starts first and foremost by seeing the human being.
That's coming up next here on Wisconsin Weeka. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to Wisconsin Weekend.
It can be tough to build community in prison, but some people who are incarcerated find community by sharing a meal. Last month on Milwaukee's East Side, a public event called Cell to Table highlighted the creative food sometimes created in prison. It's organized by The Community, a nonprofit that seeks to correct what its leaders say is a false narrative about people with criminal records. The event is a ticketed food experience that shows the meals created on the inside using few tools and few ingredients. Producer Mackenzie Crummy attended the event where formerly incarcerated people showed off their creativity in the kitchen.
The tuna wraps, fantastic. Not the tuna I'm used to in prison.
Food in prison is supposed to be awful.
This is like ahi sushi quality tuna. It's really spicy. It's really delicious.
But what if I told you that it can, at times, be delicious?
I've tasted some of the best stuff I've had in prison. I'm not saying go to prison to taste food. I just, it's, but I've had a lot of really good stuff there. So
that's Brianna Krieger. She is not talking about the food served inside the prison, which she says is actually disgusting, but the meals she and her friends were able to create in their cells together.
I made everything from like jailhouse fried rice, and we would use Pepsi and honey and It's insane. We'd make fried noodles. We would take ramen noodles and put it in a popcorn bag, put it in the microwave, let it fry up. And I mean, you just get creative.
Brianna and two other formerly incarcerated chefs are preparing a four-course meal for more than 100 paying guests. The chefs are showcasing their creativity and cooking skills they used while incarcerated. Brianna made a dessert for the event called Pop-Tart Pie.
Traditionally, what I would do when I was incarcerated is it would be creamer pudding, Hawaiian punch, Kool-Aid packages, Pop-Tarts, graham crackers, and butter. But tonight, I didn't want people dying of a heart attack eating my food, so we actually made the custard from scratch, and we flavored it really nicely with some real pureed fruit to get that Hawaiian kind of aspect to it.
While in prison, Brianna used ingredients and tools she had on hand, like a small hot pot. She could boil water for noodles, but also get a sous vide type effect by boiling meat in a tortilla bag. Her best memories, though, sharing meals with others.
Hey, you guys can take away our clothes, you guys can take away our names, you guys can take away, you know, our families, you can rip us of our freedom, but this is one thing that we have, and it's this community that we've been able to kind of forge among the debris and the rubble. So cooking brings everyone together. It always has, and it always will, regardless if you're incarcerated or if you're out in the free world.
Some other menu items for sell to table are the hookup. That's a burrito stuffed with ramen, beef chili, chicken, and crushed Doritos. A side of pineapple mackerel fried rice. And tuna wraps made by Chef Nathan Bailey. He was just released at the beginning of September and already has a job at a local food cart. In prison, he found cooking gave him a creative outlet and something to focus his time.
When I was in the cell, you know, I was thinking about, like, this is what I wanted to do. It just started tumbling for me, you know what I mean? It started working, so, and I wanted to do this. I wanted to be in the food industry, and so it's clicking. My background, I came from selling drugs, so that was a different level of people pleasing. I just switched my gears around. I just woke up. I'm like, one day, I'm like, I gotta do this. Like, I can't keep wasting my life, so.
Nathan says feeding people and bringing them joy with cooking is therapeutic.
It brought them out of that, like, I'm incarcerated, you know what I mean? Like, this is a good meal. And I've always got really good feedback from it. It's cool to get in a place like that because compliments and stuff like that in a situation like that, they don't really come often. It made me feel, it gave me that sense of, like, you know, maybe I should do this.
Mackenzie Crummy, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks to Sarah Hopeful for sound design and for photos from WPR's photojournalist Angela Major. Visit WPR.org. Now we turn to the community, the nonprofit that organized that cell-to-table event. Shannon Ross is a CEO and founder of the nonprofit, which he started while serving a 17-year prison sentence. I started off by asking him, what's the common story around people who are incarcerated and how would you like to see it change?
Generally in society, people navigate the way they understand the criminal legal system and people that have criminal records from a point of danger, fear, indifference, or they deserve it mentality. So what we're trying to do is present opportunities to hear stories that counteract that default way that we approach this issue. And none of this is to blame anybody. This is how we're socialized. We're socialized in this country to view those that have committed a crime or have been in prison from a stance of danger or fear, or they deserve it. And so we're just trying to present more nuanced and complete stories so that people can see that those that have a criminal record are not what they've been socialized to believe and are really very much so in many cases a type of person in a demographic that carries so much, not just potential, but humanity and this capacity to do things that regular folks don't because of how close those of us that have been in the system have come to the devil, in a sense, right? And so getting to that degree, you can start to find your way back and change who you are in a way that is powerful, that isn't very common for people that haven't been in that position. And so we're just trying to present, at the end of the day, greater stories to show a greater understanding of what it means to engage with a person and be a person that has a criminal record or, you know, have committed a crime.
Well, I'm sure some people listening right now heard you say that and think, well, I do think, you know, people in prison are there because they've done something bad and they deserve to be punished, or that they are dangerous and should be, you know, isolated from society. What do you say when you get that, I guess, gut reaction from people as you try to make this case?
Well, there's a couple of ways to respond to it in asking the person, like, why? Why do they think that, right? Because some people might think that because they've been the victim of a crime and they carry that pain, that anger incredibly justifiably. And so that is coloring their determination, their view. Some people simply grew up in a household where that was just the way their parents and their family and their neighborhood saw it. And then some people have never really thought about it, but they just have an instinctual reaction based on media narratives, based on the news, consistently highlighting people who had a record and then got back out and committed another crime. And so, like, each of those demographics is going to be a different way to approach it. And so at the end of the day, for each one, though, the common denominator for each one is challenging them to really say, what is the ROI on people coming back from prison? Do you want folks to be ready and stable? Do you want people returning who are going to be more dangerous? Which one of those two? And pretty much everyone's going to say, you know, unless their agenda is something different, pretty much everyone's going to say, yeah, I want folks coming back to not commit crimes again. I want folks coming back who are stable and who are not a danger to me and my family. Well, then if we want that, we have to really look at what we're doing when we have someone who goes to the system, what we're, the way we're treating them, the way we're providing opportunities, the way that the entire environment and process engages with that person. And that creates a different conversation. It takes the very justified emotions and the very justified fear based on what we've heard out of it, and it focuses more on solutions and that cost benefit. Because the key statistic in all of this is that 90 to 95% of people in prison are coming back to society.
One idea that really struck me in your work, I've had a lot of conversations about re-entry, right? What happens if that person leaves prison, finding housing, jobs, counseling maybe, and so on. You talk about the concept of pre-entry, right? Getting ahead of that, not saying, you know, the day of release, but that, I think, whole period of incarceration working toward that. What changes when we think about pre-entry as opposed to just re-entry?
And that's a perfect part of that mind shift. If we're looking at the element of people coming back to society, it oftentimes sees, and this is an unfortunate element around, I think, how we view things in America. We tend to be more reactive than preventative. And I think that's a pretty safe and fair description of how we have been for a lot of things. You go to other countries, you know, I've visited 5 different countries now in the past 2 years, and you see a different way that Europe really, really, really does things. And we hear think that reentry is the way that we should start investing in folks, because when they are close to release or after they get out, let's start getting in those resources, right? Let's start getting them a job or helping them navigate the things that they need to be stable and stay out and not commit crimes. But the problem is that's akin to educating a child when they're 17. By the time they're 18, what do you think you're going to get if you only started when they're 17? They have 16 years before that of not really having solid guidance and information and opportunities to grow. So when you're inside, if a person has a 10-year sentence, a 20-year sentence, a 5, a 30, whatever number that is, especially if it's a longer sentence, if we're focusing on them by the time they get out or close to the door, you've missed all the years when they were the most in a position to grow, to hear you, to digest the concepts and the encouragement and the possibilities of change and the opportunities as well. And so the one thing that a person has when they're inside that is a wealth that you don't have when you're out is time. They are time wealthy. And when you get out, I've spent 17 years in prison. I had significant time that I used in a variety of ways inside. And when I got out, since the moment I got out, I have never had anything close to that. It has been a whirlwind of being wrapped up in what I call the sea of freedom. So if we can get people inside to understand and give them the pathway to utilize that time wealth while they're inside, they'll be much more prepared by the time they hit that reentry phase, which is the close to release or post-release date.
What does that look like? What kind of DNA change in our prison, in our incarceration system, would it look like to use that time, you know, from the day of entry to be prepared for that day of reentry?
That's the key question, right? I mean, it sounds great, but then what does that actually mean? What does it look like? So on one side of it, it means a really significant cultural shift, which comes from leadership, which comes from the way leadership in any system is viewing the way their staff are to do their job and should frame the way they do their job. If you're framing your job as watching human beings, that turns into watching animals, and that turns into hating animals. That's kind of what you see right now. The job that systems largely have is warehousing. That's what their money is for. That's what legislators give their budget and a focus on. I know many great people in systems, especially in the DOC in Wisconsin, that want to see things go different. They want people to be prepared. But the way the money is and the way that their charter is built is to warehouse. And so when you have that as the mission, when you have that as the purpose of the funding, when you have that as the culture, you're going to have the treatment and the opportunities reflecting that, which is going to be just have beds, just have places to put people, just respond to fires and keep it so the bad news is as quiet as possible and that we're not getting a lot of negative attention on us and on the leadership in the government and all that type of stuff. So if you shift that, two things, one, the culture, and also the way you partner with entities that can come in and help, you're going to start seeing that change. So that looks like, one, having staff view their role as not just watching human beings, but in a social worker capacity, right? Like, your job is the growth of human beings. Your job is the stability of these individuals coming back to society. Your job is public safety from a standpoint of human beings being stable to be safe for society. That shifts the way you see your interactions with people inside. Two, if you're partnering with entities that are doing good out in the community, they can come in and also provide that same level of support and guidance and resources and education right away, well before a person comes home. So many organizations want to get inside. So many organizations are inside. How are we having a standard and having a partner SOP, so to speak, for the DOC and for jails that allows us or requires us to make sure that partners are getting in to meet the need and that partners are knowing that they have a standard they have to meet in doing that. That's more than just, we're just doing something. It can't just be that. It has to be you're doing something at a really high level, the same way that universities and colleges are doing out in the world. So those are the two things, and that's the way that looks.
We just heard about that cell-to-table event. Why did you decide to focus on food as part of this this education mission to humanize people in the incarceration system?
When you break bread with people, you get to see a different side of them. You're open to a different side of them. You're open to their mistakes in a way that softens your reaction, but you're also open to letting them see you, right? And so that element of it was what we thought could be a doorway to have the public and have even people who are in this work access a different part of this issue that maybe they weren't aware of, or access the issue for the first time ever. And so when you sit down, you get food, and you get a story told through the food as well, right? The food is part of the experience. It's not just good food that you can have while you hear this. It's food made based off of the types of things that we eat inside a prison, which is based off of scarcity. It's based off of limited items and the creativity that people make with those limited items. It's based off of taking things from chow hall and from the kitchen to have something more comforting. It's a whole universe of story and of experience and impact and just relevance and powerful, parts that come together to tell that story through food that people in prison knew. So how can we turn that into a real world version of these items, right? How do we make the hookups that people are so commonly aware of in prison, how do we make that something that people in the world can eat and get that story of their resilience through the making of the food?
Shannon, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Shannon Ross, CEO and founder of the nonprofit organization, The Community. Earlier, we heard about an event that the group organized where formerly incarcerated chefs show off dishes inspired by those they created while in prison. The Community has a few upcoming events in Wisconsin. That includes their five-year anniversary celebration that's in Milwaukee on November 6th. The weekend might be a good time to settle in with a book or dig into that stack on your nightstand, and we're wondering, what are your favorite reads, especially by Wisconsin authors?
Is there a particular genre you like the best, or is there a book you picked up recently that surprised you?
Tell us about your favorite reads. We're always up for book recommendations. We'd love to share what's on your reading list.
And while you're at it, give a shout out to a book group.
Send us an email at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can text us or send us a voicemail to talk about great books in your life. The number is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
And thanks for sharing your story about a love of reading.
Wisconsin Weekend is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/wisconsintoday. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.